Everybody, hey, this is David Green. I'm the co-founder of Fearless Media and your host here on Left, Right, and Center. And we're just so excited to be recording our show live in the belly of the political beast, Washington, D.C. We're at Georgetown University with an audience. Thank you all for being here. So we knew it was coming, but it's finally official. Joe Biden is running for a second term and is most likely to be the Democratic presidential nominee. And as we already know, Donald Trump is the front runner for the Republican nomination. So anyone wanting deja vu, here we go. Although it doesn't sound like everyone wants deja vu. According to a recent national NBC News poll, 70% of Americans, including 51% of Democrats, do not think Biden should run again, with the majority of them saying that his age is the reason. As for Donald Trump, the results are somewhat better, 60% of Americans and a third of Republicans saying he should not run again either. So are we about to have a race that many Americans don't want, and is this sequel inevitable? Well, we have our crew here. With us, Moa Lathy is Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was Communications Director for the Democratic National Committee and an advisor to Hillary Clinton. And Sarah Isger is Senior Editor at The Dispatch. Sarah is a lawyer who was spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Hello to you both. And Mo, thank you for welcoming us here at Georgetown.
Love
it's fantastic
having you here.
To be here. Now I'm going to ask you some hard questions.
Can we just wrap?
Yeah,
right here?
You want to just stop right there?
Yeah.
So a majority of Democrats, slim majority, they don't want their party's sitting president to run for re-election. What are Biden and his team doing wrong here?
Look, I don't think they're doing anything wrong. In terms of every couple of cycles, you get this hunger in the nation to just turn the page, to do something different, to do something new. And I think this polling reflects that a little bit. But I also hate the poll question, because that's not how we actually vote. That's not actually how we make decisions, right? Like, an election is a choice, and you hear the president reminding people of this all the time, right? You don't, if you asked me, do you want to go have sushi for dinner, right? I might say, I'm not really feeling it tonight. But you give me a choice between sushi and something else that I like less, I'll be fine. I'll be fine with the sushi.
So your message to Democrats is like, if you don't like sushi, if you don't like Biden, it's better than the alternative.
What I think the reality is that there are a lot of Democrats out there that are saying, you know, I'd love to have somebody else, but I'm fine with him. I'm fine with Joe Biden. And when you look at the alternative, we're great with Joe Biden. And I think that's where people are. That's where I think Democrats are. He's going to have no problem turning out the Democratic base. They're going to be there for him throughout this entire campaign. They're going to be there for him at the end, especially if Donald Trump is the nominee. But I think against almost any of the expected candidates, Democrats are going to be there for him. They may be also thinking about 4 years from now, and starting to think about who they're hoping will succeed him, but they'll be here there.
But isn't enthusiasm important? I mean, haven't we seen problems in the Democratic Party when there's like a less than enthusiastic reaction, particularly from, you know, like a younger base of Democrats who's, you know, supported people like Bernie Sanders? Like, isn't that really
Why you see the Biden campaign doing two things right now and doing both incredibly aggressively. One, they are trying to remind people, particularly young voters and particularly black voters, of all that they have accomplished. And number two, they are drawing the contrast with the other side aggressively right now so that they can try to gin up the negative enthusiasm, right? Yes, enthusiasm is important in elections, and it can come either positively or negatively. And so they're
going to. This is why you hear him saying MAGA extremists all the time.
Every time. But I think it's fascinating how he is trying to pull the rug out from under Republicans by going right at some of their core messaging, particularly as it pertains to freedom, reminding people of the freedoms that Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, any of the MAGA Republicans are taking away from them in order to keep people, frankly, ticked off enough to stick with them.
You're looking at your phone, Sarah, and that always scares me because I feel like you're going to pull up poll numbers that are like
extraordinary,
like literally going to make us, like Mo and I, go running for...
You want to know why people don't want a redo of 2020? All right, this is just a fun fact. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, Mitt Romney, and Donald Trump, accounting for 10 of the 18 candidacies since 1992, were born within a single 24-month period. Woof. So look.
What was that? What is that? What does that noise signify?
Come on. And that didn't even include, by the way, Joe Biden, right? This is 1942 versus 1946 birthdays that we're redoing. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are ready to turn the page, quote unquote, away from the World War II era babies that we're still electing. We've skipped an entire generation at this point.
So you'd be happy if we just said no Biden, no Trump. Let's find some, like, actually young energy to...
just literally anything. But that's one. Two, there was a poll that I found really fascinating. Actually, there were two, one from Fox News and one from Emerson Polling that looked at the Democratic field. And remember, there are three people in the Democratic field, Joe Biden, Marianne Williamson, and Robert Kennedy Jr. These are not real competitors to Joe Biden in any sense of the term. And yet, so Marianne Williamson's polling at like 6%. That's higher than I thought it would be, but okay. Robert Kennedy Jr. is polling at 20%. So, I mean, that's your sushi example. They're being offered sushi or like very strange pizza from 3 weeks ago, and 20% of the Democrats are like, I'll take my chances. Maybe the pizza's not that bad. That mold could be, you know, blue cheese-esque in flavor. So, that being said, I, you know, violently agree with Mo that at the end of the day, partisans come home. That when you hit Labor Day of an election year, it does not matter what the choices are. And frankly, it's a little depressing because it doesn't matter what the choices are. They come home, and they come home to both sides because of the other choice on the other side, which they have been told up to that point and fed a reliable narrative that the other side's evil. And I think that's where we are in our politics right now. And so the fact that they're going to come home shouldn't be particularly comforting. But they will.
Let me gin up maybe some stuff that where you will not violently agree with Mo.
Okay.
Because that's not always fun. Well, like if you as a Republican strategist were sort of building a case against why Joe Biden should have a second term from, you know, a policy perspective, from a whatever perspective, what would it be? How would you put that sort of message together?
Sure. I mean, the Republican argument is going to be, one, he's not there. This is a puppet presidency. Again, we're talking about what the message would be, not my personal message here. That he's too old, and it's not just age. It's that he, Joe Biden, is not up for the job. That you're really electing Kamala Harris as president, that as soon as he's in office, there's sort of the conspiracy version where, like, he's just gonna, like, leave and hand her the reins. But there's the other version, which is the actuarial likelihood that he will make it through a second term. Is certainly lower than other presidents who, again, weren't born circa Pearl Harbor. And that Kamala Harris is uniquely unpopular in the country and just doesn't seem to be getting the hang of it anytime soon. The third thing would be that Joe Biden said he was going to be a uniter, a bipartisan president. And we've talked about this before, that in fact his president has been a little bit schizophrenic on this point. There's been things that he's done that I think are clearly sort of bipartisan-y, compromise-y, where he's trying to reach that at least middle part of the Democratic base. And then there's been things that make no sense. Speeches that he's given that have been so wildly partisan and at points inaccurate. And I'm thinking of the speech he gave down in Atlanta about voting, where, you know, he said 19 states have passed Jim Crow 2.0 and Republicans aren't willing to stand up for voting rights. And A, four of those states had Democratic governors. And two, I'm really good at this. two, when he was then asked, and like he took some questions afterwards, and they were like, so have you reached out to any Republicans about the legislation that you want? He's like, no. Have you called Mitt Romney? No. So, you know, there's moments like that that I think have made him look very, very partisan. And so I'd say, you know, those are going to be three of the particularly negative messages on Joe Biden. And then there's going to be the larger Democratic culture war message side as well, whether that's immigration, education, by which I mean parents' rights type stuff, and, you know, athlete, trans athlete stuff, things like that.
I'll take that.
You'll take
if that's the attack on Joe Biden.
You're ready to pick that apart.
Let's go. Let's do it. Let's deconstruct a little bit, right? Age. I remember in the early stages of the 2020 primary, people made Joe Biden's age an issue. There were a lot of young dynamic candidates or younger dynamic candidates on the debate stage against him. And I couldn't flip through a cable news network without hearing people asking, musing out loud, is Joe Biden's age going to be a problem? You know who didn't think so? Democratic primary voters. They nominated him over Cory Booker, over Kamala Harris, over a lot of much younger candidates that people saw as the future of the party. Not that dissimilar. Slightly different dynamics, but not that dissimilar from 4 years earlier.
I want to change one thing. You're saying age, and I think that was an issue in 2020. I think in 2024, we're talking mental acuity, which is different than age.
Well, and I think he's eager to take that issue on.
Because I think there's, by the way, a real argument to take off my Republican strategist hat for a second. I do think there's a real argument. If you look at Joe Biden talking in 1988, like, he forgets things and is a total weirdo then, too. Like, talk to any reporter who covered him. Like, if you want to question his mental acuity, maybe it hasn't gotten worse.
Yeah, and it's part of his charm is his, people just think he's just like an average, unpolished guy. Right?
Like they Uncle said about, Joe. Was it Abe Fortas? We need even mediocre people on the Supreme Court.
Right? But people just think he's a genuine, real guy. And I think they like that about him. So that's number one. He's going to point to an economy. He's going to point to more jobs. He's going to point to getting COVID under control, right? I mean, you heard the mantra over and over and over through much of the first year. Shots in your arms, money in your pockets. And then they were actually able to add a third leg to the stool, jobs in your neighborhood.
What if the economy tanks?
Well, that's not a unique to this president situation, right? This is something every president's worried about. But he's been able to show steady improvement. The economy is better today than it was 4 years ago. And then the final thing is you can see this president really, and I wish they had started doing this earlier. We talked about it on the show a number of times in the run-up to the midterm. The more Republicans focus on these culture issues, the more Republicans focus on the war on woke and focus on restricting a woman's right to choose, the easier they make the president's reelection campaign manager's job. Right? The easier it becomes for Democrats to say, hold up. We're the ones who are trying to tackle inflation. We're the ones who are trying to tackle crime. You guys are talking about banning books. You guys are talking about when you're allowed to say gay around in a school. You guys are the ones that are trying to limit which people go into which bathrooms. You guys are the ones trying to tell women that they can't make their own healthcare decisions. So y'all do you. You do what you got to do. We're going to be over here fixing the economy. We're going to be over here fighting crime. And we're going to be protecting all these liberties that they're trying to take away from you. This is a Democratic Party that is eager to engage on that message. And I don't think people underestimate how potent that could be. We began to see it a little bit in the midterms.
Before we move on, I just want to, issues like abortion, I mean, we've talked about here, the polling suggests that there's a real disconnect between what a lot of Americans, including Republicans, feel and what the party is actually doing right now. Like, so Sarah, is the Republican Party vulnerable on an issue like that when they're up against Joe Biden?
Yes and no. So what we saw in the midterms was that abortion ballot measures certainly, I think, drove turnout. It's always hard to draw an actual causal connection, but I think you look at Michigan and it's pretty hard not to draw the causal connection. The abortion ballot measure got more votes than Gretchen Whitmer, the Democratic governor. That's the opposite of what we'd expect to see. That being said, when you actually looked at candidates, plenty of hyper pro-life candidates won re-election handily against Democratic candidates who were running on it. I mean, look at Georgia, a state that Joe Biden won. I'm not claiming that Georgia is some blue state these days, but Brian Kemp, explicitly pro-life, ran on pro-life stuff. Stacey Abrams made it a huge part of her campaign and lost badly. And even look at, and I point this out all the time, but the Democratic primary for Henry Cuellar down in Texas, he's the last pro-life Democrat in the House of Representatives. He had a primary. Abortion was a big part of it. The Democrat pro-choice candidate running against the Democratic pro-life candidate. And the pro-life candidate won. Now, was that incumbency? Was it economy? Was it his record? Yes, it was all of those things beating out abortion, meaning even for Democratic voters, abortion is still not a number one issue. And so when it's on the ballot and you're actually just getting to vote on abortion, clearly it makes a difference. But in terms of candidates and it driving voters from one side to the other, I don't think it's quite what they say. Now, let me say one other thing, though, which is Republicans have no clue what their message is on abortion, which is a different, hilarious, interesting problem. You saw Nikki Haley do this huge buildup to this speech that she gave this week of, like, basically, I'm going to teach Republicans how to talk about abortion. I'm the woman in the 2024 field. We were all like, okay, yeah, definitely tuning into this. And she gives the speech, and I have no idea what her position on abortion is. She, in fact, said, we all just need to accept the consensus of the country. And she never said what that consensus is.
With that reaction to Nikki Haley. That's a good place to end. And we'll come back to Nikki Haley,
right.
I'm sure.
That feels about right.
Yeah, that feels about right for the moment. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back to talk about the fight over banning TikTok. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
We are back again with more Left, Right, and Center from here in front of an audience at Georgetown. I'm David Green. Moa Lathy and Sarah Isger are here. And we have a wonderful audience. And I want to ask a question of all of you. Show of hands, how many of you use TikTok? Okay, it's like a 30 people, 35? A little surprising on a college campus, but okay.
No, that's because the other people are the old people. All of the young people raise their hands.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It is.
Yeah.
So we are 100% now, for everyone under 35.
Exactly,
perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. How many of you feel like you couldn't live without it?
Oh, that's heartening.
Okay,
oh, that's
so you
good.
Can live
yeah.
it out. Well, let me tell you, you might be soon.
if I have anything to say,
that's so true.
Yeah, according to the FBI and the Federal Communications Commission, the Chinese-owned app TikTok is a national security threat. Lawmakers, regulators are increasingly worried that the app, which is owned by a private Chinese company, is a tool controlled by the Chinese government who are using it to gather sensitive information on Americans. They're also worried that the government could use the app's content recommendations to spread misinformation. Since November now, we have seen 24 states banning TikTok on government-issued devices. Many colleges have blocked them from campuses. And here to talk about this, you heard her voice as we were interacting with you out here. She's sitting next to me. It's national security expert Juliette Kayyem. She's a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School, former assistant secretary at Homeland Security, CNN's national security analyst, contributed to The Atlantic, and you've written several books.
Yes.
And now you're here with us.
I'm thrilled. Thank you. Thank you for having me, David.
Is this freak out over TikTok legit? Like, well, are the Chinese spying on us through TikTok?
It's a capacity to do so. So what I want to start with is there's no question that lots of bad things are being done by companies who have access to our data. So there's, you know, a movement to get data management legislation through the United States, much like what Europe has. California has a version of it. You know, sort of data privacy protections. We don't have that. So I agree with that, and you're going to put that to the side because the argument is that TikTok is different, and it isn't TikTok per se. And TikTok will say they don't you know, dive into your information.
The argument is TikTok's even more dangerous. Like, we're used to common dangers, and this is even worse.
Yeah, that this is this company, because of its governance system. So TikTok is managed and owned by a company called ByteDance, which is basically a subsidiary of the Chinese government. So it's this way in which TikTok can sort of present itself as independent of the Chinese government, but its entire platform is run out of this ByteDance company, which has lots of different apps. And it's like the architecture is basically in China, by China. And so there have been instances in which the overlord company, ByteDance, has actually reached in to get information about some reporters. That happened in the last couple months. And I think the concern is that your data, your location can be found out if the Chinese want it to be found out. Now, that may not be a big deal to most of you. You're just like, okay, whatever, I'm at 7-Eleven or whatever. It's not a big deal. But imagine if you're a dissident or you're a journalist or someone who needs privacy from an authoritarian government. So that's the largest national security concern. You also hear the government talk about, well, they're worried that because China can control or does control the algorithm, that information, like during an election, could be controlled about what the kids, as we say, but what the younger generation is receiving in terms of how you get information. So those are the two biggie sort of concerns. And it is different. There's no other platform like it. And also, it's just huge. Like, what is it? Over 100 million Americans are on it. So it's not even... it's not like some silly little app. This is a huge app.
But I'm gonna say, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. Like your worry level doesn't feel like it's like off the charts. Like
I'm sensing
like a 5 or 6 out of 10. Like
you don't seem freaked out. Yeah, I mean, I see this for what it is. I mean, basically, for 4 years, the government has been working under this. Those of you who are in school here under the CFIUS regime, which is sort of a way in which the government, it's a committee on foreign investment within the government that sort of looks at what are these foreign companies doing in this country, and can we find some rules to sort of regulate them? And CFIUS is supposed to be non-adversarial. It works with these companies. So TikTok and CFIUS, this entity of CFIUS, which involves a whole bunch of different agencies, have been talking for a long time. That sort of erupted. It was just clear that the Senate was done. The Biden administration, which didn't want to get to the ban, is now kind of suggesting that they might get to the ban. They've already banned it from government phones, that these negotiations were not going to happen. If you ask me about my worry level, I see this as a larger concern about China, and that the battlefield that we've all somehow decided to fight it on is TikTok. But
the larger issue with China that keeps you up at night?
That would just be, can we, a country that seems to be providing to the rest of the world a thriving free market economy with no personal freedoms? See, after World War II, the model was us. It was, this is the only way you can have a vibrant economy, was by being open. And China is kind of proving otherwise, right? That you can have a system that is closed for people, right? But that could be a juggernaut in economically and therefore geopolitically.
So I'm hearing you say there are big stakes in the rise of China.
And so we decided to fight it over TikTok.
Which kind of, that doesn't sound
that
good.
That is exactly, I mean.
Like a lot of smart people in government policy are like putting all their anger, like they're venting on TikTok.
Right, exactly. And the counter to that, and of course they're not dealing with the larger data privacy issue. I don't want to be like on the one hand, but just what people better this battlefield than others. Like, I mean, in other words, a lot of people sort of think like we're focusing on this issue. We're going to assert our independence from China's capacity to look in on American citizens or control the news that they get, given its popularity. Right? It's its popularity that is its downfall, because if it weren't popular, we wouldn't really care. So if you ask me how my word, if TikTok was regulated, I'd be fine with that. I don't see the politics aligning that way anymore. I think Democrats and Republicans are aligned on being tough on China. This is a tangible way to do it. I don't think they're going to, you know, suffer much political backlash for doing it. No one raised their hand when they said, "Can you live without it?" There's people that earn their living off of it. So I just think that the politics are aligning more than, I would say, than the national security concern.
But what can they do? Can they do anything? You say do it.
There'd be two things. So there are two things that you could do. One is, or at least that the Biden administration is demanding, and the Senate is demanding. Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia, is sort of leading this, which is you essentially have to sell off TikTok from its capacity to be controlled by ByteDance, and that's hard to do, because anyone who knows technology knows these platforms are built, and there's one app here, but you know, the platforms are all shared, right? So just think of Facebook, or the shared platforms across Facebook with Facebook and Instagram. I mean, think of Meta and Facebook and Instagram. They're all sharing sort of stuff. It's sort of hard to take one piece off. And so that's one argument. The other is just a full out ban, and you're seeing.
Julia, you're going to tell me that's not possible, right?
Well, I fear that. The Chinese government can use the data that they've gathered from TikTok, sort the algorithm, and find the 10,000 Americans who are most interested in violent political videos and conspiracy theories about politics, and target them to basically try to sort of Manchurian a political violence in the country, for instance, just on 150 million people. All they need is maybe 10,000, and all they need of those is really a handful.
So you're going to tell me that's not possible, right?
Well, no, I mean, the reality is the radicalization you see sort of in the right-wing sphere, including that, like, go join the army, go join the military, that's already being directed by foreign entities, whether it's Russia or China. That's a huge problem for the Pentagon and for others, as we're seeing. You know, we don't know this guy in Massachusetts who was apparently just trying to impress people by putting stuff online in the last
the
couple
Ukraine,
of months.
Ukraine intel.
We'll see if that's the only explanation, right? I mean, that's exactly right, is that the radicalization, the disinformation we saw in 2016 and 2020 was the first steps towards the radicalization. And so that's exactly right. But that can happen through U.S. companies as well. Now, I'm worried about it, and to the extent that any of these platforms that collect our data have the capacity to be used against us, to follow dissidents, to do all sorts of things. That I get.
That sounds bad.
And TikTok's relationship with China is unique. TikTok and CFIUS have been working on what they call Project Texas, which was a way to better manage this information, get the data out of China, put it in the United States. You have it overseen in the United States. TikTok employees don't get paid by any entity that has ties to China. There are ways in which you could conceive that they could do this. But for China, it's going to be hard to find an app as infiltrated and popular as TikTok anytime soon. Any other app that you would think of is just not going to have the kind of penetration that TikTok does.
Does this have the chance of driving younger voters away from people in power even more? Like, if people, in general, TikTok users are younger, and they're like, these old people in power are just trying to ban an app, and they're not giving me a good argument why, and
I hear that, but I think
there are a few arguments. I mean, I hear a number of Democrats out there arguing that AOC, some of the other younger ones. I cannot think of an argument I hate more than that, right? If your only argument in defense of TikTok is we might lose voters if it goes away, right? Like, that's not a legit argument, because there are real implications here. And it's why I think there are a few things I can point to right now that actually show that have actually garnered more bipartisan support. And it seems to be focused on a couple of areas. One, the data stuff, right, that you were talking about. Two, you're seeing really interesting political bedfellows talking about mental health issues for young people, and how TikTok is sort of the poster child of bad tech practices there.
And you're seeing like some of the most conservative members of the Senate hanging out with the most progressive, focusing on these two pieces, right? China bad, mental health problems. To come back, if the response is going to be, yeah, but we're going to lose young voters, like that's a really bad argument.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Juliet Kayyem is a national security expert, author of the book, The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. I love the title, and it should be required reading for all of us who want to live in the world today. Juliet, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And we're going to be right back to talk with our next guest, Tetsu Kor, about music, America, and guns. You are listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I am your host, David Green, and I'm sitting next to Ketch Secor. I first met Ketch 11 years ago. I interviewed him on Morning Edition when I was at NPR, and we talked about his song, Levi. It's about Levi Barnard. Ketch heard a story about Levi on NPR. Levi grew up in the mountains near the Virginia-North Carolina border, a country boy, Ketch told me. He was also a fan of Ketch's band, Old Crow Medicine Show. Levi listened to Wagon Wheel all the time. Levi went to fight in Iraq, and that's where he was killed. And the song Ketch wrote to remember Levi is haunting and beautiful. You see veterans at Old Crow shows crying when they hear it. And I saw immediately when I met Ketch how special he is. He's a brilliant artist, a poet, musician, father. He also started an Episcopal school in Nashville. And I've been so lucky over the years to call him a friend. And so when I saw Ketch in pain some weeks ago after a school shooting in Nashville took 6 lives, 3 of them kids, he was on my mind. And I read the op-ed that Ketch wrote in the New York Times. He wrote that what the South needs now is an anti-assault weapons movement driven by voices from the center, including country singers who are tired of bending to the whims of fearmongers and who are ready to speak from their platforms to an impressionable audience. And Ketch is with us to talk about the movement he's begun. And I can't thank you enough for being here. Thank you. Can we start, if you don't mind, with the moments when you learned about what happened at the Covenant School? You're a parent, you run a school. This was in your hometown of Nashville. What did that moment feel like?
Well, it was a real shocking thing that happened in Nashville about 10 o'clock in the morning on a Monday in the very end of March. Well, what really struck the most was that the kids who were killed were 9 years old, like my kids are, and like kids I know and in classrooms I'm always around, and that the head of school was killed, and that a teacher was killed, and that a custodian was killed. So it just feels like that's my family, even though I don't know these folks. And I carried their names with me on scratched on the back of my fiddle. They're in my hearts right now in Washington, D.C. I've become close with the deceased.
And you came to a place where you feel like as a country singer, you have an opportunity to make a difference and a special role that you could play because of your connection to your audience and you know the communities where you bring your music. What tell me about that belief. Like what do you feel like you can do because of who you are?
Well, I've been thinking about this, y'all, like a kind of blueprint for a country singer who's bigger and more brazen and has a larger piece of real estate on the Jumbotron than me. I feel like if I can go out and embody the change that I want to see in my business, which is a business rooted in the South and rooted in tradition, and in some of the areas of the nostalgia of the South's sensibilities, which plays so heavily into the ideas of the Second Amendment being, you know, a impenetrable wall that must be protected I think of it in the same ways as the edifices of the South that we see, like the Confederate monuments. You know, when I grew up in the South, I never thought that those would ever come down. Why would they? Well, then they did, and it felt kind of normal when they did. And I think that 10 years, 15 years from now, we're going to see sweeping changes in gun legislation. But it's about how are we going to start it, because 25 years since Columbine is way too late. You know, Evelyn and Hallie and William, 9-year-old children in Nashville, who laid down their lives because America can't figure out how to solve this problem again and again and again. And I stand in my business as a person who's, you know, I got my platform, and I deal with a lot of rural folks, y'all. I see them every night at the gigs, and I love them to death. And I can look past the things that I don't agree with them on, fundamentalism and Christianity. It's not my thing. Having a whole bunch of pow, pow, pow pistols and whatnot. I mean, that's that part, I can kind of look past some of it. But I don't know. I don't ever want to tell anybody what to do. For me, it's about 9-year-old kids. And now I think that I can agree. I think that the left and the right ought to be able to come together about 9-year-old kids. And why not let Nashville be the last nail in the coffin?
You know, there was a word that I keep thinking about since traveling with you for a couple days last week, and thank you for letting me come along. I called you and I wanted to see up close the kind of thing you might be talking about. And you know, I rode with you on your bus to North Carolina, Pilot Mountain, and we went to a gun shop during the day a few hours before your performance, and just, you know, we talked to people, and the word that keeps coming in my mind is respect. Like I felt like we walked in the door and there was no judgment. It's not like, you know, they thought that you or, you know, or I or anyone was coming with an agenda. Like, you know, I was asking questions like, you know, explain to me, you know, when you talk about an AR-15 and why it's necessary to protect your property, like, you know, tell me what that means. And, you know, I was learning about, you know, shooting hogs and shooting coyotes. Where is the balance? Because I think a lot of people who are so angry, like you are, seeing kids slaughtered, are like, I don't want to have a conversation with people about, you know, listening to their needs to have a semi-automatic weapon. But I also felt like something so important was happening, like that needs to open the window to conversations. Like, what can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's frustrating to me that there's these two things going on. One, an urgent need for a change to be made to protect America's kids and not allow them to be these sacrificial lambs, because the second part of the problem is an inability to get something done, a marginal line in which we just push against it, and yet it's just a war of attrition. You just gain inches. And everything you gain, you lose right away. And you might have everybody crowing about what you got, what the left stole from the right, what the right pushed back and stole back from the left. Meanwhile, kids are dying. I can't believe that those two things are happening at the same time, and yet they're happening together in this bizarre dance. You know, I thought about this, and it just made me cry out in the night as I thought about, like, some future, you know, archaeological dig on us in 2023, as they're like, well, what were they like in America in 2023? And I realized that maybe some future, you know, archaeologist, anthropologist would deduce that, oh, they sacrificed people. They sacrificed children, in fact, to this god of fighting, to the god of indecision, to the god of tribalism, feudal politics, of silos of thinking. You know, they got these two spires and they sacrifice kids every day to these two big camps to make sure that they would always stay diametrically opposed and that everybody could make a lot of money on that happening and everybody could keep putting a flurry of attention towards it. You know, as soon as As soon as the graves were dug, all the media trucks pulled out of Nashville, and they all drove up to make sure that, you know, Trump and Stormy Daniels and all that was all resolved. And everybody followed them, except us in a community that was like, you don't go, stick around. You know, mourn with us. Let's talk about how this is horrible. You know, this is the death of children, the future of our society. Sacrifice to our indecision.
What do you hope for when you leave conversations like we left in that gun shop? Like, what are you trying to take away? What are you trying to do when we make a stop like that?
Well, like, being at the gun shop was cool, because I walked in with you and it was like a thing. They were like, you're the boys that sold out town today, you know? This is a town that hadn't had a big gig, you know? And it was like, there was like thousands of people at this show, and there was, you know, vendors and rides and things. It was a lot of fun. And a lot of my people, you know, they're from small towns, and small town America has a pretty hefty arsenal. Small town America's really pissed at DC. They think that a lot of y'all look down your noses at them. And it kind of harkens to an age-old sort of the victimization of the South, for better or for worse, you know. I mean, I don't know. I've been in the South my whole life, and there are some really lovely people who live in all parts of this country. The fact that there's camps in, you know, the western states and in the flyover states or whatever, where you might feel like there's this fractious nature between, you know, the coasts and the middle of it all. When I make music, I like playing on the coasts too, but they're a little snooty on the coast. Nothing personal, y'all. Where I love them the most is where they really get down. Like, they'll hold a baby up in the air. Or they'll hold a bottle up in the air, you know, or their sweetheart, or whatever it is. They throw down. I like that about where I play. I know that there's an energy that can be corralled there, that somebody like me, who's regularly engaged with the population, and I walk in a gun shop and no one thinks, well, here comes an East Coast liberal, you know, trying to take my AR-15 from me. You know, the man there behind the counter, he said, would you like to see it? And I said, yes, sir. Show me that one. You know what? And I picked the cheapest AR-15 off the wall, because I'm kind of that way. I pulled it up to my cheek, and, you know, it just feels like a toy. It's not scary at all when you hold a gun like this. It's not scary at all when you're in a shop full of guys who are all just, there's granddads, there's kids, there's, you know, camo pink guns on the wall, you know, so that girls can learn to be, you know, Mark's women too. And this is where I'm from. And these are the people who, those of us who want to see the assault rifles gone, need to negotiate with. Because I don't care how who's at the table, I don't care, we just got to start. Because Evelyn and Hallie and William demand it.
You wrote a new song, you know, kind of coming from the feelings you've been having, Louder Than Guns. And, you know, I watched you play it in, you know, Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, Pilot Mountain, North Carolina. And I'll admit, I was sort of wondering what the reaction was going to be. And, you know, you know, there's some strong lyrics. You talk about, you know, the Second Amendment, a law on a dusty scroll from a feather pen, and you say, this time I don't agree, you know, which I think is you venting your anger and your pain of what you've seen. But you also, like, you're so careful when you introduce this song to dedicate it to teachers, which, you know, just listening to you tonight, like, I hear that as your effort to reach out and say, like, we all need to feel this pain. Like, wherever you're coming from, whatever you own, like, we need to feel this pain together. And what is it like when you get ready to play that song and you look out at an audience in a place like Western North Carolina?
Well, the reason, David, that it works is because the pain is the thing that the sides have in common. You know, that's where we meet. you know, right and left come together at this, at the point of our shared grief for the ones that we love. I don't think there's anything better to unite on. So when I say, you know, I want to sing one for teachers and for kids, you know, everybody's goes to something that they share, and it's diffused. Now then, if I can sneak in a little bit about how I think that there's a technicality on the Second Amendment that's allowing these pow-pows to go by so fast, that, like, I flew in from Nashville today, I flew right over Mount Vernon, I thought about George Washington and his pea shooter, and that's just not the same kind of arsenal that those guys were scribing. You know, I just don't see, and I held that gun, y'all, and it's just a high-powered toy. It's, you know, it's something to brag about having, or like the dude said, you know, do you need a special gun to shoot coyotes? I don't know that you do. I don't know that a civil society allows that high-volume type of magazine to exist, particularly when we see the way that it's been, you know, misused in our society. I think the time's coming. I'm just wanting to be on the right side of history here.
I know you have your friend Dante Pope with you, the fabulous percussionist with Old Crow, and you're kind of going to end the show for us by, you know, playing us the song Louder Than Guns that you wrote for this moment. And before you go over and play, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, Catch, for sharing this with us and for the movement that you're trying to start and build. The stage is yours.
Oh, great. This is Dante Pope.
This morning, it was Groundhog Day. I saw the same black veil on a crying face and a flag flying halfways. But this time, it was people I know, gunned down in a minute or so. Only God knows when it'll stop, but these thoughts and prayers ain't enough.
Louder than guns, more powerful than bullets flying, is the voice rising up, saying it's about time. We put the last nail in the coffin, we put the last body in the ground.
We're calling on every town,
shout
louder than guns.
There's a law on a dusty scroll from a feather pen. It says every man's right to defend shall not be infringed. But this time, I don't agree.
Ooh.
Any man should have his own army. More than an American child should live in sweet harmony. Sing it
louder than guns. More powerful than bullets flying is a voice rising up, saying it's about time. We put the last nail in the coffin, we put the last body in the ground.
We're calling on every town,
shout
louder than guns.
I don't want to wake up on another Groundhog Day. No, I don't want to hear another rat-a-tat-tat-tat echo down the hallway. Freedom's just another word for letting every voice be heard. Every heart, every hand, every town take a stand, sing
louder than guns. More powerful than bullets flying is the voice rising up,
saying it's
about damn time. We put the last nail in the coffin, we put the last body in the ground.
We're calling on every town,
shout
louder than guns.
More powerful than
Big thanks to Ketch Secor and Dante Pope from Old Crow Medicine Show, Juliet Kayem, Sarah Isger, and Moa Lathy. We really appreciate Mo hosting us here at the Georgetown Institute of Politics and Public Policy. Special thanks to Robert Yoon and Zachary Royster from Georgetown University and Maggie O'Rourke from KCRW for making this live event here happen. Also, enormous thanks to Blue Street Productions in Washington, D.C., Russell Gordon, Chip Burden, and Alan Thomas from Blue Street. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Singer Schiff. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I'm David Green. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week. We'll have a whole lot more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
from PRX.